Yeah, actually, I have a friend of mine, a former student. He works at Sweetwater. And right when this whole thing started happening, I asked him, I was like, hey, man, so, you guys doing okay? And he's laughing. He's like, oh, dude, we're doing just fine.
Of course.
He said, it's because of exactly what you just said. He's like, oh, dude, everyone's starting a podcast. He's like, he's like, we're selling so many podcasting kits. It's unbelievable right now. Great.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. And I started mine in 2017 when I was still in my undergrad, but I took like a year and a half hiatus, like when I started grad school, and I just picked it back up when the pandemic started. And I was like, well, I mean, I got nothing else to do, so, might as well. And now I've influenced two of them, and those two guys have like these incredible like connections. Their teachers are great and everything, and it's like, man, those are going to be really good podcasts. So it's like, it's there's going to be a lot of good information coming out. I saw you shared something about a new one today.
Yeah, Tommy Dobbs is coming out, and that's going to be great, just focused on pedagogy. Another friend of mine, Jamie Whitmarsh, has one coming out. So, I mean, there's a lot of it's all good information. Like, sure, let's put it out in the airwaves and just see. The only thing that's a bummer is that just the market gets saturated at times, and then it's hard to like, well, I can't listen to everything.
Exactly, yeah. How long has Casey been doing his?
It's been a while. I'm sitting here at my computer, so I guess I can look that up real quick.
Have you been part of it since the beginning?
No, he talked to me about it in the beginning, just like, would you like to be a guest at some point? Oh yeah, sure, that would be awesome. At Percussion. Which was great. He's got 241 videos. And if I go to videos and I go back to, let me just sort by date added oldest. Episode one was 4 years ago. So he's been doing it for
four. Yeah, that's ahead of the curve.
Yeah, so he's been doing it for 4 years. But he just asked me if I wanted to be on it at some point as a guest. And I was like, yeah, sure, that would be great. And then it turned into, I guess I did okay enough to where he had a couple of guests come on where sometimes his other hosts weren't available. And so he's like, well, could you guest host this with me? Yeah, sure. Sounds good. And then it just kind of evolved from there to where I'm just kind of like, I'm one of the ringers. So it's like when one of the normal four can't do it, he's got a list of like four other people, and I'm just one of them that he'll put out.
Nice.
I'm a sub. We've got a Facebook group or not group, but like a Facebook Messenger thing. And I'll just get a message, be like, hey, who can join us for this date? It's going to be this person and whatever. Oh, okay, cool. Blah, blah, blah. He's been super cool about it. And yeah, he gets great guests on, and it's always a good time. So it's a blast.
Are you, you're recording, right?
Yeah, totally. Cool. I don't know if you want to use any of this.
No, I do. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, that's totally fine.
I prefer to do it like this, actually, where we just record and talk. I always forget to record sometimes. In the pre-recording conversation, I'm like, dang, there's a lot of good information in there.
We're good this time. if I've ever learned anything, it's always be recording. It's always be recording, and then
absolutely.
Especially with a lot of the recording projects I've done over the past few years and stuff, like we record just about all the time, just for the fact of when we get like a nice blooper or something like that, or someone screams after it. Like it's like, we'll actually mark those in the track sheets. Be like, oh yeah, Melinda totally said something right there that we need to export that real quick. So yeah, sorry, Melinda.
Yeah. Your setup's probably way more legit than,
other people's setup. Not really right now, because since we moved to Lake Charles, we moved into a smaller house. And then when COVID hit, my wife and I basically had to combine our offices into one so that I could bring like my vibraphone home and stuff like that. So it was kind of crazy. And what it turned into was, I don't have even the only the only part of my actual setup that I normally have is I have my two monitors and my laptop here, and I have my small Personas interface here. But like my actual like studio monitors, mixer, anything like that, none of that's set up at this point because it's just not, there's not enough space. And I can get away, I can mix things in headphones right now if I need to and do stuff like that. So it's like I can get away with it, but I just have like an old Kilpsitz desktop speaker thing. Like it's I don't even remotely have what I would normally have, but you know, it's what make it work.
Yeah, of course. I mean, how are you guys liking Lake Charles though?
Yeah, we like it a lot. It's and there's nothing against the places we've been, but the last two places we lived were Dickinson, North Dakota and Troy, Alabama, which are wonderful places with wonderful people, but they're small. They're both
North
like
Dakota. Yeah. Brave.
They're both like sub 20,000 people. So of course, they're very, very small. And, you know, it's just not exactly what we're used to and what we really would have ideally liked to live in. So Lake Charles for us is like this booming metropolis, you know, which I'm sure a lot of people laugh at having come to Lake Charles. Yeah. But, you know, like 70,000 people, we're just like, oh, my God, like what? There's all this stuff and whatever. It's just we're so used to it. But I think it's a good thing for us because it's really conditioned us to appreciate what it's like in other places and stuff.
Of course,
so we're enjoying it a lot. We've made a lot of great friends. You know, enjoy the university.
Hang out with James. James Lorman.
Oh yeah. He comes over about once a week, once every couple of weeks. Him and Jay Sconyers, we have what we call nerdy board game night. We're playing all sorts of just crazy complex board games that Rachel and I own and stuff. And
You play Settlers?
Catan? Oh yeah. Yeah. That was the first one that Jay, I think, enjoyed because it was the first one that he kind of really grasped what was going on.
I love Settlers. Oh yeah. It's great.
We've played a lot of Settlers.
Get the expansion pack.
We have the expansion, but we haven't used it yet because we've never played with enough people to necessitate it. But
yeah.
The new Woodwind faculty, Ben Cole, just moved in literally next door. I'm looking at his house right now.
Wow.
And he is him and his wife are big board game nerds as well. So the hope is to have them over with James and Jay, and then we'll have six players. And so I'm sure we will be doing some Settlers with the expansion soon.
Hey, when this is all over, if y'all want me to hop over to Lake Charles, I will do so.
That
just to play Settlers.
All right. Man, it's so funny, like how, in a way, how awesome it is because of the internet, but also like the time sync of everything is like you can find anything on there. And so one night I lost really badly in Settlers. And so my wife walks in, we're getting ready for bed. She walks in, I've got my iPad out. She's like, what are you? And she hears that I'm watching something. She's like, what are you watching? I'm like, I'm watching the Canadian World Championships of Catan right now. She was like, what? I'm like, yeah, this is,
that's a new level.
It's a new, over the quarantine, I've watched Catan videos. I've been watching a lot of, there's this board game that Rachel got me for my birthday called Scythe. That's super awesome, but I am awful at it, and Rachel has decimated us. No one has beat her, and we're talking she wins by like 30, 40 points like every game. You're like, oh my God.
Incredible.
And so like I've gotten to like where I'm watching videos on that, and I'm watching videos. We both love disc golf. We both play. In North Dakota, that was basically all we did was played a lot of disc golf in the summer.
I played a lot of ultimate frisbee in high school.
Oh, nice. That was one I never got into, but
a lot more running.
Yeah, totally. But we in North Dakota, we had a friend. We had a park that was less than a mile from us that had a disc golf thing. And then we became really good friends with a guy that was super into it. So he brought us around, showed us what's what with it. And then especially like in the summers, dude, it would not be outlandish for him to call and say, hey, lunch break, want to do a round. Cool. Do that. Then we would go get, then he would get off of work. We would go do another round, go get dinner. And then there was another course that we called the short course, that was just a smaller course in another park. And then we would go and play that after dinner.
Man.
So we would play like 20, you know, we would play a ton in one day. So we've gotten big into that. So I've been watching a bunch of like disc golf videos as well. And so I'm just like, oh my God, I'm such a nerd.
Brody's, there's that guy, Brody Smith.
Yep.
Who's a YouTuber. He also has a golf channel. Do you play real golf?
Very poorly.
Okay. So James and I are super into golf, mm-hmm. right? With our friend Mike Royer.
Oh yeah.
And yeah. And, we'll go play like probably once or twice a month. Since I've been back here, and, James and I are often having 45 minute to hour long phone conversations about how we need to improve our game. So it's very like, we all like, we're such nerds in a way of like, we're drum nerds as well.
Sure.
I mean, we've all gone this far.
Oh yeah.
With drums, it's no turning back now. I was like, man, golf is just like drumming, man. I'm telling you, it's just like drumming. And like, we're all having like philosophical conversations about how we're comparing drums to golf. So it's just like, it gets really out of hand.
But it makes sense. I mean, it's really just the fact is now, anything any activity, you can put as much thought as you want, as much time as you want. Like, the rabbit hole goes deep on anything. Yes. You know, I always, you know, think about how many, you know, mallets we own for that specific thing. And so then you just apply that to anything. Like the guys that are playing professional disc golf, how many discs they have for their specific things that they need to do.
Exactly.
You know, how it just goes on and on. And how many, you know, for the audio guys, how many plugins do they have? For the composers, how, you know, for the media composers, how many sound libraries do they have? And then all of these things, you can go onto YouTube, type in a very general term, and get a million videos, some of which are going to be awful. And, you know, that's the double-edged sword of the internet, is that there's so much content out there. There's going to be some stuff that's just a waste of your time, but there's also so much great stuff that when you find it, that's why there's a subscribe button, you know?
It's kind of like watching a bad clinic or a bad masterclass, like of somebody who maybe not be as qualified as they think they are. And like, your teacher brings them in anyway, just to show you how to not present a clinic or masterclass. And you're like, oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, I always try and look at it like, even if you can always learn something from someone, even if it's not, I don't want to say what not to do, because there's a lot of different ways to do things. But the fact is, right, there are ways that are going to resonate with you and ways that are not going to resonate with you. This seminar that I was telling you about, we've had two roundtable discussions so far with Omar Carmenades, Dave Hall, Gemma Peacock, and I. And and yeah, it was funny getting into a couple of them. Like, there were a lot of times where we were all on the same page, and it was just like, yep, like, I do exactly what you do, and I agree 100%. And then there were some times where some person would say something, and I'd be like, I actually don't do it like that. I actually, I would disagree only in the sense that I perceive this, or you perceive that, and whatever, and stuff. And so it's always interesting to get those different takes. And I think that's healthy. I think that that's a good thing. I think it's good to see, especially for students, to see that not only is there not just one way of doing things, but that people that are, not to say that I'm the end all be all, but the people that are at a high level on any activity can have different viewpoints. I mean, if you look at, right, look at how people play timpani. Oh, it's the Duff School or the, you know, the Goodman School. It's like, well, guess what? They both sound amazing.
Yeah.
So they're very, very different techniques, but they both sound amazing. Or who plays Stevens grip versus Burton grip, or versus traditional grip versus, you know, whatever. It's like, guess what? They all sound amazing. So at the end of the day, you find out what works for you. And you just take all that information and you just process it as best you can. That's the best thing that you can do. And then find what way works best for you.
Yeah. And I definitely found towards the end of my master's of really formulating what I thought would be my philosophy and my way of doing things in general. And taking, you know, that's what made me really, really glad that I just went straight into my master's, was because it was such a different world from my undergrad, where it's like, okay, now I'm getting treated like a colleague as opposed to just a student. So now I have some input and a little bit of direction, and control and how I want to do things. Mm-hmm. So, that was really refreshing. And now I kind of have like this, a little bit more of a forged path to go forward.
Sure.
In my own playing, in my teaching philosophy and all that kind of stuff. So, that's one of the things that I really loved about grad school. And I'm sure you could say the same, because now I just feel like I'm getting started. I mean, the undergrad was so, like, McNeese was so incredibly important for me to, like, kind of grow up and, like, and get all my musicality at a good foundation to where I can build on top of it. So, yeah, I feel like now I'm just getting started. And so when I do see a clinic or a masterclass and I don't fully agree with them, I'm like, oh, okay, this is good, because now I can kind of just take what I want and apply it to what I want, kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's that idea of that kind of critical listening idea, in the sense of just like, I tell students, especially when we're talking about composition, I'll tell students, okay, one of the best things you can do is, you know, actively listen to a piece of music, ideally with a score. And then as you're listening, ask yourself the simple question of, do I like this? Yes or no? And then from there, the more important question then is, why do I like or not like this? Because it's really easy to say, oh, you know, it's just not my style. I just don't really dig it. It's like, but that's just the cop-out answer. The better answer is to sit there and go, okay, well, what are the things that I don't like about this? Oh, I don't like the texture that's going on here. It's just a little contrived to me. I don't appreciate that. And the melody just doesn't really seem to go anywhere. It just kind of meanders, and I don't really understand why or whatever. And so if you can start to figure those things out, all of that information then ends up being tools for you for what to avoid, for what to capitalize on, whatever. And then you can apply that to, yeah, anything. So if I'm watching a clinic, I'm sitting there taking every trick I can from them. And then also, yeah, paying attention to when someone maybe sadly like stumbles on something or says something and I'm like, I don't really buy into. Well, okay, I'm going to sit there and listen and be like, okay, so why this person says this is the only way to do this? Okay, why do they feel that way? Let's see if they go into why this is the end all be all best way to do this thing that they're talking about. And then from there, I can either go, wow, that man, he actually does make a lot of sense with that. You know, maybe I need to talk to her more after and find out why she says this. And she brings up some really good points, you know, or whatever. And so information is always good, whether because it'll teach you what to do or what not to do, or it just makes you question and think more. And, oh, you don't have the answer just yet. So all these things are valuable, I think.
I mean, if we ever get back to clinics and master classes in the near future,
yeah,
you know,
it's getting there. I mean, that's, but you know, it's, we're getting to a point though, which is interesting, where all of this stuff is shifting. There's like this big kind of almost paradigm shift right now because of COVID-19. I have a clinic that, as soon as all of this happened, a friend of mine said, hey, are you interested in trading, you know, or he was like, hey, I'm trying to have a guest in. Could you do something this week? And I was like, maybe let me think about it. And I went through, you know, I have a folder on my computer that's just clinics, and it's all my PowerPoints and keynotes and like all these things. And I was looking through and I was like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. If I just take this one, would actually work great over Zoom. Like, mm-hmm. I can do all the things over Zoom. I don't have to be live in any way, shape, or form to do this thing. Yeah, let's do it. So I think that it's, you know, it's a challenge for us in a good way, where you're going to start to see, I've already got people picked out that we're going to do clinic exchanges through the fall. No one's going to be traveling here. No one's going to be coming in live. I mean, at least for us at McNeese, we don't even know exactly how live is live going to be. We don't know whether we're meeting hybridized. We don't, like, just no decisions have been made yet. There's a lot of talk and there's a lot of options. I think we're still just kind of waiting to see where all the chips fall.
Everything's up in the air.
Yeah. But it, you know, I think you're able to still develop and have these things. And I think it's going to force a lot of people to go, okay, well, I'm a drum set, you know, guy, and my clinic has always been this thing and this is what I do and I need a kit and whatever. It's like, well, you might not be able to do that, dude. Like, that might just happen. Mm-hmm. Or an orchestral orchestral specialist or whatever. Like everyone is going to have to sit down and go, okay, well, if clinics are a major part of what I do and I can't travel anywhere now and people can't have me in live to do this, hey man, it's time for me to figure out what I can offer in this new virtual environment. And right. So I think it's going to be a good thing.
Do you think that, because traditionally our academic pathways are not very applicable in throughout the virtual landscape. So do you think someone could earn a percussion degree online? Because the percussion ensemble, the playing aspect, the ensemble, chamber ensemble aspect of it is extremely important.
I think it would be a vastly different degree than what you and I have. Right. Like, for example, like I know that with these streaming services, you know, with Zoom, with even Skype, FaceTime, all of that stuff, they don't handle audio in the greatest way. There's some compression going on. There's all sorts of things. So where you're not getting the truest sound possible. So what I would say to that is, okay, let's say we have to go down that road. Like, hey, you've got to develop a completely online virtual percussion performance degree. One of the very first things that would happen if I had to do that would be, okay, in addition to your theory, your aural skills and ear training and, you know, all of that stuff that you need to do in your first year, their non-negotiable would have to be an audio technology class. You would have to take it. And guess what? Some of the gear that you would have to purchase, in addition to owning this pair of snare drum sticks and this set of four mallets and a practice pad and a metronome and all that stuff, you'd have to own an interface, mics, mic stands, because I need to hear what you're doing. But even from there, they would have to get
at a high quality.
Yeah, I would have to hear it at a high quality to be able to give you comments. What is your touch like on the ride cymbal? What is your, hey, if you're giving me a forte piano, you know, and you know, if you're playing me some Delacluse snare where the dynamic range is all over the place and there's all those sudden shifts, sorry, like Zoom is not going to handle that well. You're going to do that. You're going to go from forte to piano and I'm going to have no idea what's happening right there. So in order to do that, like I knew that going into even this past spring when we knew like we're about to go online. So I actually did no Zoom lessons. Instead, the lessons were take your phone. The day of your lesson, you are required to upload a run of whatever it is you've been working on. And as you're working, if you're like, I'm running into a problem, you can just say, hey, Brian, like, so in this section right here that I just played for you, I'm really having an issue with this thing. And if you could address that in your comments, that would be great and whatever. And so they were required to do that. Because the other thing I've also noticed is if your internet connection is bad, I've had to go in. I've had a few times where people have like, hey, would you Skype in? We're playing one of your pieces. Would you Skype in so that you could listen and give us comments? The audio's never ideal. It's sometimes it's acceptable, but the internet connection, if all of a sudden they're doing a full run of the piece and all of a sudden I miss 8 to 12, 16 bars because the internet, you know, messed up and all of a sudden it was buffering and I lost it and whatever. Well, what am I going to do now? Tell them, oh, hey, I need you guys to go back. I didn't get any of that or what. And so I thought the best way to do this would be you're going to just record yourself, send me that. And then from there, I will watch it. ideally, if it goes that way again, what I'll actually do is I will watch it, make comments, but I'll then also watch it with you in a Zoom call.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
then we can talk about it kind of live there. But that to me is the best way that you can do that. So on that note, not only are you going to have to video record, but I'll also say, hey, and you need to have the audio needs to not be the mic on your computer. It's got to be going through your interface. Set that up so that I can get a good sound quality, or so that I can talk to you about all of these things that we need. So I'll be honest that at least right at this point, I don't know that it would be the best of experiences, just like with what we're seeing with elementary, like with K through 12 education. I mean, there's been studies that have said that the kids are not getting the same amount of education that they're getting face to face. This, you know, this hybridized, you know, virtual learning, all that is just not as good. Yeah, that's not shocking to me. I think it may be good if we are really forced to do it. Like, hey, this is all we've got. We're all going to be living on our own little islands for the rest of time right now. We've got to figure it out. Yeah, I'm sure that we could probably get there eventually. But right now,
it'd be rough at first.
It would be rough at first. And we're going to be constantly tripping and constantly learning how to walk again before we learn how to run. And what that's just going to be the matter of it. But here's hoping it doesn't get to that. Here's hoping that what we really get is they're able to figure out the health issues. They're able to find a vaccine. They're able to do all these things. Hopefully people will, I don't want to get political, but hopefully people wear the masks. They do the right things. They social distance. They do the things that were needed so that we can get back to what we know as normal, what it was before.
Normal,
yeah.
Right.
And we can get to there and we can just move on with improving ourselves the way we were before all of this.
I think the main thing that would suffer the most in a virtual percussion degree would probably be, keyboard playing, timpani playing. I feel like you could do maybe, I feel like you could do this, the third, fourth, fifth years of a percussion degree if your education, I feel like you could do that online, just because those students at that point probably have the fundamentals down. If they're on the right track, probably have the fundamentals down of keyboard playing and snare drum playing and timpani playing. Now you're just doing kind of like some refinement, or you would have to have kind of some kind of rotation thing of like, this student's allowed to be at the school for this set amount of time during the week or whatever. So I hope it doesn't get to the point where we have to figure out something like that. But, you know, it at this rate in this country, at least we might have to, but you know, it makes me kind of glad I finished up when I did.
Sure.
I mean, I finished up in May and I was like, man, if I had to deal with this, I would not be happy.
No.
Because I'm going to school to play and to learn how to play my instruments more proficiently and try to be the best player I can be. But how am I going to do that if I'm, you know, playing on a practice pad 8 hours a day or whatever it is?
Right. Well, and beyond that, there's so much more to the educational experience beyond just the, you know, honing your chops, right? I mean, first off,
right,
if we just go along the lines of performance, there's, well, chamber music, there's playing with others, there's ensemble playing, there's all of those skills that need to be developed. You know, everyone will tell you, like, yeah, playing Scheherazade on snare drum, like working up that excerpt, is great. And it's sound, if you can play it well in a practice room, that's great. But it's a totally different ball game when you've got to play snare drum in the orchestra playing Scheherazade.
Yep.
It's a completely different thing.
You got to listen to the upper woodwinds across the ensemble, or, you know, whoever's playing that rhythmic line, whatever it is. It's just nightmare.
There's all those things, right? So, and then there's also the idea of, you know, chamber music, like learning how to communicate with people, learning how to cue, you know, like all of those things are a significant responsibility and some of the most valuable skills that we have. And if you aren't developing them, that's a problem. That's a big problem. So there's those things. And then honestly, the other side of it is that human interaction, like just getting to network with people, getting to know people, like the human interaction is such a huge thing. Like I, you know, most of the gigs I get now or the people that I interact with, they're my peers. They're the people that I was in with, I was in school with, that I was interacting with, that I've developed relationships with. And if you don't have the opportunity to develop those relationships, that's going to be exceedingly difficult. Like I feel really bad for anyone that was starting their college experience this year, because it's just nuts the way all of that has worked. And we're better off than we were because we do have the internet, we've got social media, we've got conference calls, we've got video communication and stuff like that. So that's great, but it's still not the same thing.
Yeah. You know? I mean, just a question just for my curiosity. What was your college path, like undergrad, master's, like where was it and where did it all take place?
So I've got a weird one. Or, well, I shouldn't say weird. I've got a unique one. I grew up in upstate New York, whole life, same town. And then I did my undergraduate at Virginia Tech, which seems like a weird place to go for a music degree. But the person that I was taking private lessons with in New York had gone there for his undergrad and said, and I walked in one day and said, you know, sophomore year, I was like, I think I'm going to go into music. I should probably learn how to play mallets at this point, because I was basically just a drum set player. Okay, well, you should check out Virginia Tech. And so I went, and the campus was beautiful, and I resonated with some of the people there. And so went, did that, really got into composing when I was there. I was into composing in high school only for basically my rock band. I was in like kind of in a progressive rock band. I loved like writing stuff for them. I loved like figuring out my parts and like writing those things. And so I got into it there. Started to get more serious about it when I got into undergrad, decided at the end of it that I was going to be a composer. That's what I'm going to do. So I got kind of dual focuses in performance and composition. Went to University of Miami to get a composition master's and fried out in a semester. Just fried out on writing. Something happened where my brain just wasn't. I realize now, looking back on it, that I had phenomenal teachers that I wasn't taking advantage of at Miami, but really for what I wanted to do, because I really at that point wanted to write music for video games. That was like what I wanted to do as a career at that point. What I should have done was not the composition, the traditional composition. I should have done a media writing program, which they had there, but I was ignorant. I didn't know any better.
That's Frost, right?
Yeah. Frost. So I decided at that point, all right, well, I'm going to go the academia route. I'm going to do the percussion performance route. I'd rather be playing now. So I was a composition master's student, but I was also weird because at the same time I was doing that, I was the head instructor of the drum line, co-principal of the wind ensemble, I was taking lessons with Ney. I was in the graduate percussion ensemble. So I was doing like all this playing, but I was getting a comp, but I was getting a comp degree, and I wasn't doing enough writing because I really fried out and stuff. So I knew if I finish this degree, it'll make me more marketable for a college teaching position. So finished that, got out of there, moved back to Virginia, got my old job as a phone operator back. For like 6 months, just like, all right, I got to do something. Well, I can go back there. I can have practice facilities. I can earn enough to live and then do that. And I was also very ignorant about the ideas of like trying to get gigs, like going and sending out my resume to orchestras and trying to build a private studio. Like I just didn't do any of those things. I was very, very ignorant at that time. Ended up getting an adjunct position in Georgia, then after 6 months after moving back to Virginia, moved down to Macon, Georgia, taught at Mercer University for a year and a half. And one of the reasons that I did that was because Andy Harnsberger, who I knew, was like an hour and a half away. And I'm like, I wasn't making the progress as a player that I wanted to up in Virginia. I was like, oh, well, I know enough. I'll just teach myself and I'll improve and blah, blah, blah. And I was not doing that. I was like, I really need a teacher.
And was Marcus Reddick at Mercer at that time?
No, Marcus was two teachers after me.
Okay, I love Marcus. Just a side note, you know. Okay. Yeah.
So I moved to Mercer, took over that position, was teaching there for a year and a half while taking lessons with Harnsberger. And at that point, I just had to really make a. I had to take a tough look in the mirror because my hands just weren't where they needed to be. I took some lessons with John Parks at FSU, who has become a good friend and a mentor to me. And he was just very honest and upfront with where I was in the grand scheme of things for what I needed. And it basically came that, okay, well, I have a master's, but I'm not good enough to get a doctorate. It was just like flat out, like my hands, I am not a developed enough performer to get a doctorate. So I had to swallow my pride and go get a second master's degree. So that's when I went to North Texas, got in there, went there, got another master's in performance.
And Christopher Dean? Mm-hmm,
yep. So nice. I studied with him and Paul and Mark, Paul Rennick, Mark Ford. I got to study a little bit with Ed Sof, which was great. Ed Smith.
Oh, man, I want to take lessons from him so he's bad. He's just a legend.
I still have the VHS tapes of my lessons with him. They're like worth their weight in gold. Like, there's so much knowledge in there. It's
how much you want
for
him.
Yeah, that's not happening. but he was great. And it was exactly what I needed because it filled in all those gaps in my playing, all the things that I hadn't been able to develop. It filled all those in and put me to the level where I needed to. Then from there, went straight to the University of Kentucky and got my doctorate there with Jim Campbell.
Yeah. So you're part of some alumni webs and networks that are very, very close knit, and they're proud of the alumni networks they're in. Miami, especially when is Nay's not there anymore.
No,
right?
Now it's Svet Stojanovic. I said that right, which I've actually never met him. I don't know him at all. I know his work. He's a monster and he's turned out some phenomenal students, but I don't know him personally. Kentucky, especially North Texas has a tight knit network as well, but Kentucky, at least in terms of percussion, is probably the tightest knit. You know, the UK,
y'all got you get the UK pins y'all put them on the name tag.
Kentucky mafia, as it was joked about,
absolutely. With Mr. Campbell being the godfather himself.
Yeah, Jim is a riot on many levels, and I owe him. he's become a good friend, and he will always be a mentor, and there's a reason we hold him in such high esteem, you know. So I'm very.
Of course. I mean, all the way back to Mike Gould, who was Dean's first, I guess, first GA.
Okay.
And conversations with him, the couple of times that I've hung out with him, him talking about both Dean and Jim, it's like, man, it's almost like he got just extremely lucky and having these two incredible mentors that have these 30 plus years of network, you know, alumni systems and all these great students, you know.
Well, and you know, and that's the. One of the things that I think is so valuable about Jim, and one of the reasons that I think he's so successful at everything, at the things that he's done, is because of the fact that he had a clear vision, but I also think in many ways he had the right vision, which is
right.
We had a few, it's a ways away now. It's going on. Like, it was a while. It was a number of years ago. We had a 30th anniversary of UK percussion, because Jim was the first full-time percussion teacher at Kentucky. So we had a 30th anniversary thing, and it was like a put out the call, any alumni that want to come back, we're going to be doing like a thing all weekend and whatever and stuff. And it was awesome. And one of the things
we did that for Dean last
year. And I think that those are really valuable and important. And one of the things that happened, just looking around that room at like some of these people that are here, like, oh my god, this is crazy. But one of the things that I thought was beautiful was Jim said, you know, when we were like, you know, finally like a speech type thing, you know, he was very succinct in what he said, but he was like, you know, when I started this, he's like I had one goal, and it was to build a network of people that cared about each other, cared about music, and were there to support each other. And looking around the room tonight, I feel that I've done that. And it was just like, yeah, dude, like that's,
I would say so as an outsider looking in, I was like, I mean, the names that are associated with Kentucky and people are doing great things, and they have been since they graduated from there. It's I think he's accomplished that 100%.
Yeah. But the bigger thing to me was just the fact that, you know, he didn't sit there and say, I started this wanting to make the greatest percussion program of all time, or I started this because I wanted to win the call for tapes more than anyone, or I started this because of that. It was like, no, he had the vision and he had the right vision, or he just had a very pure and beautiful vision that wasn't about accolades. It wasn't about being the best at something. It was about people. And I thought that he said that, it was just like, there it is. That's why Jim is Jim. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, being a part of a relatively new alumni network and in McNeese's, and then one that is still building, and you know, thanks to Lonnie and to yourself, but then being part of one that was 30 years deep, mm-hmm. already, it was two different dynamics. Like some of Dean's oldest alumni are building their own alumni networks themselves, like Brian Mason,
oh, totally.
Or Lonnie, yep. or And you're sitting there and you're like, or Mike Gould, yep. and Marcus Reddick, but you're sitting there and you're like, man, how can I contribute to what's going on here? And so with McNeese, we knew we were building something. We knew we were building a name for ourselves, but we were too young at that point. We were just trying to do our own thing. But with UNLV, it was like, okay, I got to make sure I'm contributing as well, just to keep this train a rolling. Because Dean's already said, he's like, I'm going past 40 years. Just letting y'all know. I'm like, all right, well, you know, I guess I gotta, you know, do something here. And so, I worked my ass off in both degrees, but there was something about that little thing in the back of your mind, which I'm sure you understood at Kentucky, where it's like, okay, how can I make my mark? Kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, you ideally when you're coming into any venture, whether it's a degree, or you're playing in an ensemble, or you're starting a project with other people. Yeah. You're ideally you're going in wanting to contribute in the best way that you possibly can to that. I think where people get tripped up sometimes is where they feel that, well, this is what I do, and so this is what I'm going to contribute. And sometimes that's maybe not necessary. Sometimes what's really needed is just to be able to sit back and go like, all right, well, what do you need me to do? What's the, you know,
being a team player.
That, and that's really such a key thing, you know, knowing that you've got X and Y and Z that you can contribute, but hey, guess what? If none of those are needed right now and you're willing to pick up the slack on A or B or C, like that's a huge thing, you know, being the guy that, oh yeah. I'd really love to, you know, be Paul Rennick's, you know, chauffeur and just like shadow him all day and make sure he's necessary. But oh wait, no, what's really needed right now is someone needs to go on a coffee run. Hey, I can do that. You know, I can do, yeah. I'd rather not, I'd rather sit here and watch this great clinic or whatever, but you know what? Hey, if that's what needs to be done, that's what a team player does. You know, and I think that that's a valuable skill.
Dean always compared a percussion studio to being like a sports team, like a locker room, mm-hmm. and everybody had their role and everybody was trying to develop themselves. But at the end of the day, it is a team effort.
Yeah.
It's why often he would refer to himself as a coach, not a teacher, mm-hmm. and just letting people kind of figure it out, which is three words that I've heard a lot in my life at this point, especially by the great Lonnie Benoit, but being told figure it out is something that didn't really resonate with me until probably like my second or third year, where I was like, oh, that's what it means to figure it out.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things, that's kind of almost one of my pet peeves to a degree is when, like, you have, like, right now we have this incredible resource that is the internet.
Yeah, YouTube University.
Yeah, I mean that, or just, I mean, we have so much information at, like, literally in our pocket on our phone, right? And yet it is amazing to me. There's this person that I know that I will remain nameless, but this person would call me with logic questions, like, all the time. And yet all I could think was, wait a minute. If you literally just typed your question into YouTube, there are five videos I know that would come up that are like 3 minutes long that would tell you exactly how to do that.
I've probably watched them.
Yeah.
Myself,
so it's, so, you know, it's one of those things that it's like, if you're not, don't waste other people's time. It's one thing if you've done the research, you've looked and you've scoured the internet and you've scoured books and you've scoured and you can't find the answer to that. Cool. No big deal. That's fine. And I get that sometimes you're in a pinch. You're like, dude, I need the birth date of this guy right now. I don't have time to, like, but I know that I can text my friend and he will have it. Like, sometimes these things happen. I get that. But for the most part, it's like, if you have a question, do your own research, do your own work, put forth your own effort to try and find this stuff. And then from there, if you can't, then it's the time to start asking other people.
Right. Can somebody tell Eric Samut to put his birth date up, please, on the internet? Thank you. Because it took me forever to find that. Come on, Eric.
It's funny you say that. Like, yeah, there's a few that I've had to ask a few times. Like, oh, when's this person? And then I felt bad because I would get frustrated like that, not for Samut, but for some others. And I'm like, oh man, I really need to keep remembering that and whatever. And then all of a sudden, I looked at my bio. And I had enough people that had contacted me like, hey, what's your birth year? And I'm like, oh, man, I'm the problem. Right. I'm that guy. I'm the problem. So I like had to go into my website. Brian Nosty, born.
Fact, I think I asked you when I played your piece Downside.
Probably. And it's to a degree that's on me. Like, it's not really out there public knowledge. I'm like, OK, so I had to jump in there and like edit my bio. So it has the little born 1977. There we go. OK, cool. Now it's up there. Now, if anyone said, I can just be like, all right, well, it's this year, but you know, that's on my website, right? You could have just gone.
Yeah.
So,
of course. Well, that piece, just a quick note on that piece was tough, but I enjoyed it. It was from my senior recital at McNeese. It was a lot of fun.
I appreciate that, but you are a brave soul because, yeah, that piece is stupid.
I only had
hard.
Four mental breakdowns, so it's
well,
okay.
And yet I wanted, so I blame Scott Herring because Scott,
South Carolina,
because Scott asked me to write it, and Scott asked me to write it, and I watched, like, when I was trying to like get ideas together and stuff, I watched his video of him playing Carbon Paper Nitrogen Ink by Adam Silverman, his marimba concerto. And I'm just like, dude, this guy is a monster. Like, I already knew he was a good player, but I'm watching him play that. And I'm like, oh, my God. I was like, I've got a thoroughbred racehorse in front of me. I should probably take advantage of it. And so I wrote some things that are just, they're just stupid hard. And I regret them. It's all the stuff in the beginning where you're jumping all over the place on the board, all those octave. I was like, that was dumb. I should not have done that.
What? No. So for that part, I was like, ooh, I'm going to have to stretch because I'm not the biggest dude in the world. So I was like, I was way out there, and I'm a Burton player. That's the first piece in a while I had to switch the stance. Yeah. So
I felt really like, I feel bad now looking at it. I'm just like, oh, that was dumb of me. I should not have, like, you know, it's just, it's the things that you do and you're just like, oh my. And then, but the funny thing is, like, I actually have, so when we were recording it for Scott's CD, I've got videos of like, I was staying at his house and I would be sitting there like fixing some things and he would be, I'm on the floor next to his marimba. He's at the marimba playing it, practicing things. And he'd just be like, oh, and I'd be like, dude, we can change it. I was like, I'm not like, and there were a couple things where I was like, well, what if we made this lick this, would that flow better for you? Yeah, that would. Okay. And he let, but there were a couple, he's like, no, I'm going to get it. Like I'm doing that lick.
Eventually for that piece, it became that for me because it was, I had learned everything except Raybon's A and your piece. And when I look back on that recital, I'm like, what was I thinking?
You, dude, you were, whew.
Yeah, I was on, I must've been in fairy tale land because, geez. And, I'm never playing Raybon's A ever again. If, even if I have to, I'm going to find a way to get out of it. And, I look back on that program and I'm like, oh my God, I locked myself away for like 5 months and I was reaching pretty far, but it made me way better on the other side of things. I will say.
Well, I'm glad that you enjoyed it, man. That means a lot. And yeah, I'm just lucky that, I mean, people seem to enjoy it. So I'm thrilled that people are getting something out of it. So that makes me happy.
Yeah, of course. I'm interested to see the amount of compositions we see coming out of this quarantine where people are just sitting on Sibelius or Finale and during the past 4 months and cooking up whatever, you know, compositions they have an idea for.
I mean that, you know, that's the, that is, I try to be a silver linings kind of guy, you know, and what good things are happening here? What pros can we get from, what advantages can we get from this? And yeah, I think that, you know, the amount of people that have gone away and, gone into their own little, you know, workshops and, you know, mad scientist laboratories and what are they coming up with? Yeah, I think it's a valuable thing as long, you know, I've tried to be productive. I know a lot of other people have tried to be productive. Like, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
I've tried.
It's going to be interesting to see. It'll also be interesting to see what innovations come from this. You know, who comes up with, you know, repertoire that is, you know, that is specifically designed for the situation we're in right now, knowing all of the pitfalls, knowing all of the difficulties, like who's going to come up with, with some stuff, it's like, oh yeah, you want to play that piece that's specifically designed to be played over Zoom, you know, or something like that. Like, I think that that's where it'll be, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. So I'll be curious to see. I just got an email from Murray Gussick at Tapspace about something. And one of the things he mentioned was, you know, that they've on Tapspace's like search bar now on their website is a spot just for COVID-19 rep that can be played.
I need to
like,
check that out.
With this idea in mind. Now, I don't know that necessarily means like Zoom type stuff or virtual type stuff, but things that can be played socially distant. Things it can be like things that don't require like all sorts of stuff like that from the minutia of just like, oh, things that don't require sharing of instruments. You know, or things that can be things that can be spaced out, socially distant, like all sorts of. And I was like, oh, that's just brilliant. So I'm really curious to see where that stuff goes.
One of them is, and Stopa. I don't know if you know Stopa.
Yeah, he actually just did a clinic for McNeese. He did a Virtua clinic a few months ago. He's great.
Yeah. So he's become kind of a mentor of mine, and you know, being when I was in Vegas. He helped me out a lot, and you know, hopefully I can get back out there and you know whatever. But the as far as like, he has this one piece for body percussion that you could do like spaced out like 20 feet from each other almost. Like it's I'm sure it's all through Tapspace. I'm sure that'll pop up on there, but that's an interesting way. I'm glad they did that because it needs to be organized like that right now, especially for this fall semester where most institutions are going to go no ensembles, no in-person kind of thing. I know UNLV is. I don't know what. I'm sure most institutions are going like, okay, let's figure something out.
Yeah, I'm still not sure, but like I've got, all right, a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, you know, just for, okay, what do they hit us with? And okay, so yeah. Oh, cool. We're going with plan B. Cool. That's fine. You know, plan A would be everything's normal. I am 99% sure that's not going to happen. So, all right, got to have those other ones. And yeah, it'll be, you know, and then it's, yeah, it's the picking of rep, you know, finding out, talking. And again, like what we were talking about before, like the things that we're lacking, if we were all online, like it's that network. Like I have a group chat with my friends that I know I could text right now and be like, I need suggestions for rep that I could do remotely with my students for a percussion ensemble setting. And I'm sure I would get a laundry list from those people, you know? So, but yeah. If I only grew up getting my degrees online virtually, I'm not going to get that same level of connection, you know, and that's a real sad thing. So here's hoping that this situation goes away as quickly, but also as fully as possible. I mean, it could go away right now in the sense that we could all just say, to heck with it, we're all going to go out and we're just going to do our thing, but that's not going to solve the problem. That's only going to make the problem worse. So my hope is that it goes away as quickly, but as safely and as fully as possible.
The kind of, I guess, composer class that you're in, would you say you're in the same kind of, I guess, era is the term of like maybe Casey, yourself, Dave Hall? Is that kind of like your class, you would say?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, like those guys, you know, Gene Kaczynski, Caleb Pickering, you know, and I feel bad even saying names right now because I'm sure there's so many super talented composers out there that I feel bad even saying these names because they're all really talented, but I'm sure I'm going to miss some. And those are just I guess I'll preface that.
Ivan.
Yeah, Ivan would be another one. Absolutely. You know, those being the quote, the percussionist composers, because there are so many wonderful composers out there that aren't percussionists. You know, this seminar that I'm doing right now, one of the best things about it is the fact that I've gotten exposed more to Gemma Peacock's writing because she's a brilliant human being. And seems super nice in the interactions I've had. She seems like a sweetheart of a person as well. But in addition, yeah, her music, she's writing killer stuff. Mm. But in terms of the percussionist composer, yeah, I guess that would be the crew. I'm like the era, if you will. You know, David Skidmore, obviously, and the guys in Third Coast would, you know, they're all writing so much of their own stuff as well. Yeah, I guess that would be the era I'm in, I guess.
The because you do the At Percussion podcast with Casey. And so the thing that I like to see, and we touched on this a little bit before we started recording, but the thing that I'd like to see is the amount of percussion media we're starting to see. I think that's one area that we could get a little bit more modern in as a community. I feel like we could get a little bit more just kind of involved in the media landscape of podcasting or maybe some YouTube channels, more YouTube channels, like kind of growing our community to be, because while we are, I guess, considered part of the drum set world, you see like these Zildjian Lives, you see these Vic Firth jams, the live jams kind of thing. And we're just not quite there yet because I guess it's because of, you know, obviously the different, I guess, etiquettes behind the instruments we perform on. But, do you feel like we're moving in the right direction as far as like maybe getting some more media exposure and growing the maybe growing specific instruments, I guess, like the marimba, like people are starting to write and arrange for the marimba, like for folk songs or, you know, my friend Nathan Smith, who's a composer, is starting to do a lot of folk song arranging to make the marimba more of like, because like he plays like in coffee shops and stuff like that.
Sure, sure.
And making it like not a popular instrument, but I mean, you know, making it more accessible to the average listener. So My question is, I guess, is do you think we're moving in the right direction for percussion as a whole?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, it's always going to be niche.
Yeah. Well, So, if you go back to what you're talking about with like the drum set, the reality to me is that the drum set is the most popular, shall we say, of the percussion instruments, because
right.
it's tied to the word popular for pop music. Like, that's mm-hmm. why, like, you know, everyone knows what a drum set is just about, because they, you know, whether they've listened to, you know, whether they listen to the Beatles or Beyonce, like, there's a beat and they understand that that beat mm-hmm. is synonymous with the drum set, ideally, even if it's, you know, an 808 synthesizer, you know, it's an electronic thing. Like, it's still evoking the beat that we get from rock and roll and stuff like that. Right. And the early rhythm and blues and all of those things. So that's why I think that the drum set is the popular one. But one could really argue right now that probably the next most popular thing right now is marching percussion. You see the Absolutely. Evolution of WGI. I mean, I think it's, I don't know the stats on this, so I could be wrong on this, but I would imagine that WGI has definitely become the more popular entity if you compared that to DCI. And I think both are I never did WGI, but I marched and I taught DCI and I have a love for that activity. But I think that both are both have their place and both can coexist. And I think it's a beautiful thing, but that's where things have gone now. And I think that there's an advantage to that evolution. And maybe this is getting a little bit off the subject of what you're saying. I think that there is an advantage to the evolution of those activities, that it does get students, younger students, more into certain instruments that maybe they weren't going to get into before. So, like, for example, me growing up, drum set was the gateway drug. Drum set was the thing that got you into percussion. I want to be a rock and roll drummer. That's what I want to do. Da 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 da. You did that, and then you went, oh, there's this thing called marimba, or there's this thing, the vibraphone, and whatever. And how do you play that? And, oh, that's kind of cool, and whatever. And then the next thing, and then the ball starts rolling, right? Now, what my observation, at least, has been is now you have a student that is a phenomenal marimba player because they grew up playing, you know, they went from the rack player in their marching band to playing the marimba, which then turned into, and now you're playing, so you're playing marimba in the fall, and oh, now we have a Scholastic WGI line, and now you're playing marimba in that, which then you're, oh, and now you're playing marimba in the front ensemble for that drum corps, and you could literally play marimba all year long, or vibraphone, or just be what, like, you could any of these, right? And what I worry about personally is I think that there's a beautiful thing to that in the sense of, like, okay, it's getting kids exposed to these other instruments that maybe weren't as exposed to before. Like, I it pains me to say this, but I will say, like, when I was growing up, like, mallets were the girl instrument. And I know mm-hmm. that's wrong. It's an awful view.
I've had this discussion,
but it's a reality. It was like, oh no, that's the instrument that the girls play. The guys play the drums, you know? And it's stupid. Yep. Absolutely stupid.
So it was a very weird way of putting, like, you yeah, know, it was, even back then you're like, well, I mean, not really.
Yeah. And so luckily we've moved hopefully a bit past that silly mentality now. But the fact is that now what I worry about and what I see sometimes is people that become so one dimensional that, like, yeah, they are a monster keyboard player, but they can't play a buzz roll to save their lives, because all they do is play that keyboard instrument throughout the entire year. And we used to see this in, like, marching guys that, like, yeah, they could play, they were a monster tenor player, but they really couldn't do anything else because they would just play tenors the entire, you know, time, and they wouldn't bother to learn other instruments and stuff. So I think we're going in the right direction to a certain degree, but there's certain things that I worry about. I worry about that one dimensional effect, but to get a little bit more with your question, what you were asking, I think that there are I think that there's a lot of stuff that's coming out. There's, you know, just about everyone has the ability to put out high quality audio and video recordings now. I think that that's great. You know, we have the ability to put out these podcasts and stuff, and we're our network, because of social media, is getting so much more intertwined in a good way that, yeah, it's not outlandish to have like some of these really luminary guest artists, you know, come into podcasts and be able to share their knowledge and whatever. And I think that that's great. It just becomes difficult when the market gets saturated. So I think the only worry that you ever have there is making sure that anyone that decides to do a venture like that needs to understand that whatever you put out can't be just a thing you throw together. It's got to be a high quality. And also asking yourself, like, what do you bring to the table? That's, I know, at least the thing that I talk mm-hmm. about a lot with composition students is, if you're going to write a piece for, you know, if you're going to write a marimba quartet, that's great. Awesome. Love marimba quartets. But you need to go and listen to pretty much every other marimba quartet at least once so that you understand what's already been done. And so that you're not replicating it, so that you're doing something that is new and contributes to our repertoire. As like, we don't need another, you know, we don't need another unfollow centric lecture. We've got one and it's great. We really don't.
We don't need another Sculpture yeah. 3. We don't need yeah. another.
And I mean, even if you look at, like, that's one of the things I love about, like, I bring up unfollow because if you look at Nigel Westlake's two marimba quartets, that and Calabash, in ways they're similar, but they're also in ways vastly different from each other, to the point where I would right. never look at Calabash, the second one, and say, man, why did he do this? We didn't need this. Like mm-hmm. it's different enough to where I'm like, oh, this is super hip, you know? Right. So I think that anyone that wants to put out anything new and contribute to our field in any way, whether it's a podcast, it's a new composition, it's a new online method of a school for something like that. Like, I think that that's great, but I think that you just need to ask what you bring to the table. Yusuf right. Shronik has a killer, I don't want to screw up and say the wrong, I hope it's okay that I play, framedrumschool.org. That's phenomenal.
That.
And I did, I was supposed to do him and Glenn Velez's intensive in Connecticut, and it got, you know, obviously canceled, and they went online, and I had a great experience with the online version of it. But prior to that, to try and study up, I went and did a month of his Frame Drum 101. I had bought a tar at PASIC, and I was like, all right, let's get into this. And it's phenomenal. And that's like a really good example of like, okay, there's not anything that I know of out there like this. I think there actually is one or two others now, but Yusuf, being a trained educator, like, knew exactly how to lay this out, laid it out in a curriculum fashion, like all these things. It was really, really brilliant and stuff. So that's like a really, so anyone that wants to do something like that, a podcast, write a new piece, like any of those things, the best thing that you can do is know what's already out there and ideally contribute something new and like something that you are able to contribute. What do I as a person bring that's different from these other things that are already out there, and how can I put my own spin and my own take on it?
Right. And I think you have to be very, very aware of what the history is and what everything else and what everybody else is doing mm-hmm. right now. And I feel like that's extremely important, because then we're just going to be keep repeating ourselves, writing the same marimba solos for students to play, writing the same percussion ensemble pieces and multi pieces. And, you know, I think we are moving in the right direction, and I feel like especially hearing about, you know, frame drum schools or something, you know, online frame drum schools, that's a step in the right totally. Direction, because and now people have more opportunity to make a career and have an internet aspect of it within percussion, which is, I think, crucial, and especially with, you know, like electronic percussion, too. You got people that are making careers off mouth mm-hmm. stations. I know I follow this guy on Instagram who's literally putting out daily mouth station videos. And, you know, it's just, it is percussion. That's, you know, it's something that is modern and I think will be more integrated into what we're doing. I mean, if you think about how many snare, like there's an entire book now of snare drum pieces with electronic tape that Sean Tilburg put together, that it's a great book.
Yep, it's phenomenal.
I've played a solo out of that book and it's awesome. And I was like, man, if this is what percussion is going towards, I'm totally fine with it. I know there's going to be some traditionalists that are not going to like that, but for me personally, I'm like, I think this is a step in the right direction. And you got tippity pieces that are coming out with tape, and you're coming, you know, eventually we'll get some crazy, you know, just electronic percussion pieces, like I guess what Arizona used to do under
Crosstalk and stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Crosstalk. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the future is bright. I think people are going to start growing their careers in ways that are not conventional now, but they will be. And you know, whether that's the, for example, like the Brian Nosny online percussion school or something like that. And it's like, you know, it does seem tangible at this point. And that's one thing that this pandemic has shown.
Well, I mean, if you look at like Drumeo or something like that, you know, it's a channel where you can subscribe and you can get these lessons. You can get all these things like,
Mike Johnston.
Yeah, it's viable. It's a possibility. But if you're not doing a high quality job and you're not really thinking through how to actually develop these things, you know, that's where like you're going to fall by the wayside eventually, you know.
And YouTube, if you look at YouTube videos now of anything, people are recording YouTube videos with movie cameras if they have the means. Like the quality, I guess, ceiling is pretty high right now. So, and even the cameras they're coming out with now, it's the same with audio equipment. The equipment that's coming out right now that's at that low price point, it's really great. I mean, I record all my podcasts on this AT Audio Technica 2035. It's like the second lowest condenser mic they make. And I get quality audio out of it. And so it's just, I think it's more attainable than people think. The ceiling is pretty high, but nonetheless, it's an opportunity to make great content for yourself and market yourself, which is, you know, something like if I want to make a cinematic video of me playing Chameleon, then I can do that. And it's not that hard to do that.
I think the technology has gotten to a point to where it's accessible to anyone if you're able to afford it. And even if your budget is lower, you can still make some really, really high quality material. Like it's possible to do all of that. What it just takes is committing the time to learning how to use the resources that you have, you know, and then also having a high standard, that's really one of the big problems that I hear where if I'm listening to a video and I'm like, wait a minute, you made this super high quality video with all these camera angles and all these things, but your time is awful. It's, you know, it's like, wait a second. Like your priorities were too far skewed to one level. Oh, the quality of the video and the audio has to be great. Well, yeah, but the quality of the performance has to also be impeccable, you know? And if it's not, that's not going to be good. Everything has to be, you know, in that 90th percentile. Otherwise, it's almost not worth doing to a point.
Well, it'll get swept under the rug, which is, you know, something that I'm trying to do with this podcast is to make it up to standard, but also maybe set a new standard where quality of guests, quality of recording, quality of conversation kind of thing. You know what I'm saying? So it's something that I think the percussion community needs. And to seeing all these podcasts come out and all these YouTube channels and everything media, it's like, okay, let's try to just push the envelope here. It's something that I think we need as like this little niche community of percussionists where everybody really does know everybody to a certain point. Like if you get as far as you want to get. And, you know, you're at PASIC and all of a sudden you're at PASIC 1 year and you're saying hi to a bunch of people and you're like, man, when did it get to this point? But then it starts to resonate with, you know, someone like me. I'm like, all these people are watching. So you need to make sure that quality is of the utmost priority. And within composition, performing, networking, podcasting, whatever it is, totally. You know what I'm saying?
Well, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's great, man. I appreciate you having me on. It's been a blast.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, Dr. Brian Nosny here. The, was this, you just completed your first year?
Yeah. Yes. First year.
Interesting, first year for you.
It's been a doozy, but, happy to be here. It's been great.
As an alumni, we're glad, you know, I'm going to speak for all the other alumni and say, we're glad you're there and, yeah, keep doing great work, man. I really appreciate
it. Thanks, man.
The time.
Likewise.
All righty. That's it for, this one. You can follow the Rudimental Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, all the major streaming platforms. Leave us a rate and review. Also, there's a little support link in the description where you can subscribe to support the podcast for just 99 cents a month. I'm going to be making a video about that soon. But yeah, that's it for this one. We'll see you next time.